Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
I'll tell you more later.
Welcome to the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. We not only have a full overflow crowd, but we've actually got a larger assembly of Brookings senior fellows in one place than I think has occurred in recent history. So it's very nice to see my colleagues. But seriously, we are here in the wake of President Obama's latest press conference relating to the events in Iran, in the wake of dramatic developments there, which may be the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end. We'll get into that in a moment, but it clearly will have profound, the events in Iran will clearly have profound implications for the whole Middle East. That's because Iran has been a driver of strategic relations in the region for at least the last decade, particularly in recent years. And it was that context, its bid for dominance in the region, its efforts to project its influence into the Middle East heartland, into the Arab-Israeli arena, and, of course, into Lebanon, and in particular, its drive for nuclear capabilities, notwithstanding the efforts of the international community through successive Security Council resolutions to try to gain some purchase on that program. All of those things have really, I think, dominated the Middle East agenda, and in particular for a new Obama administration as it seeks to address the challenges in the region, from Arab-Israeli peacemaking to independence and democracy in Lebanon to the threat to the stability of friendly Arab regimes, and to the whole question of trying to head off a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. It all comes back to Iran. And so it was in that context that Ken Pollack, in particular, with support of his colleagues, who I'll introduce in a moment, thought it would be very timely to do a policy exercise of assessing the different ways, different options for dealing with Iran. I immediately jumped onto this idea because when I was an administration official trying to deal with the very difficult problem in the late 1990s of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and Bruce Rydell was a colleague of mine in those days when we were confronting a very real challenge there, I received on my desk a publication edited and authored by Ken Pollack about the policy options with Iraq. And it was one of the few documents, policy analyses from outside the government that I found truly useful. And so Ken has, with the support of his colleagues, replicated that exercise in the case of Iran. Which path to Persia, as he will explain, looks at the variety of options for U.S. policymakers as they contemplate how to deal with this Iranian challenge. One of the problems that we faced was that we were in the midst of this exercise when the Obama administration came into office. The president had a mandate to engage with Iran and had, in effect, chosen one of the policy options. But Ken argued, I think, we can see now the wisdom of that, that we could not tell exactly what would happen in Iran, as in the rest of the Middle East. One had to expect the unexpected. Indeed, you'll see in the concluding chapter a section precisely on that. And engagement might well fail. Chances are it probably would fail. And therefore, the policymakers would still be confronted with the same questions, and the study would still be relevant. And I think if you look at the conclusions, you will see that one of the things that the team looked at was precisely the potential for the kind of opposition that has suddenly emerged in Iran as a result of the attempt to steal the elections. So this is a very timely and I think very useful exercise. I was very proud to have the chance to participate in it, but I was also very gratified that we had so many of our Middle East experts contributing to it. I want to introduce them quickly to you, and then Ken will present the basic findings. Suzanne Maloney will talk about the current situation. Bruce Rydell will discuss the strategic developments, and then I will lead a conversation with all of them. Bruce Rydell, senior fellow in the Saban Center and the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, former CIA official for 3 decades, and has had just about every other Middle East policy position, particularly in the White House, where he served in the NSC as Middle East advisor to 3 recent presidents. Ken Pollack, director of research at the Saban Center, soon to become the director of the Saban Center as I move up to a different position. Not only a CIA analyst himself on Iraq and Iran, but also served in the White House as director for Near East Affairs with Bruce Rydell. And, of course, the author of several notable books, in particular relevant in this case, The Persian Puzzle. Suzanne Maloney, senior fellow in the Saban Center at Brookings, who works on domestic politics in Iran and their influence on foreign policy, is writing a book about that subject, has done a number of very important policy monographs related to the issue of engagement with Iran, and has also served in the Policy Planning Department of the State Department. Mike O'Hanlon, long-time senior fellow at Brookings, a defense analyst with a huge reputation. I think he is far and away the most productive author in the Brookings stable, and is a much appreciated member of this team for his deep knowledge of defense issues. And finally, Dan Byman, who's also a senior fellow in the Saban Center, and is an expert on terrorism, served on the 9/11 Commission, has also worked in the CIA on these issues, and has published a number of books, in particular on state sponsorship of terrorism, where, of course, he is focused on Iran. So that's our lineup for today. Without further ado, I will welcome Ken to the podium to tell us what he's discovered.
Good afternoon. Thank you all very much for coming out for this. Our purpose today is twofold, as Martin already suggested. We did want to tell you a little bit about this new publication that we have, Which Path to Persia, and draw some connections between it and what's going on and what hopefully will be happening in the next few weeks with regard to U.S. policy toward Iran. But we also kind of wanted to take the opportunity, because all of us participated in the drafting and crafting of this product, to also kind of just put on display in one place at this critical moment the glittering constellation of Brookings stars with expertise on Iran, so that we could have us all together in one place and talk a little bit about the current crisis and current developments. So we'll get through this. I'll run you through a quick overview, and then we can get to the good stuff, the current stuff that I know all of you would like to hear our thoughts on. This is just a quick little intro, and the book will be coming out in 2 months, it will be coming out again in book form from Brookings Press in 2 months with that cover on it. You're all fortunate. By agreeing to come here today, you got it 2 months early, and you get it for free. If you'd like to come back and buy a copy of the book, which will be identical, we welcome that too. But for now, consider yourselves all very fortunate. This is just a kind of a quick overview of what we were trying to do. As you can see, the idea was to have kind of a big options memo. If we were back in government, what's the kind of options memo that we would want to put together for the administration? And of course, as Martin pointed out, we started this project well before the administration came into office, and had it not been for our good friends at CIA and NSC, this product would have come out in March. As it is, it's coming out in June, but nevertheless, we wanted to have this kind of a big options memo to allow every member of the administration, every American, every person who cares about Iran to get a sense for what these options look like. Our most important criteria, therefore, was to try to present as objective a portrait of each one of these options as we could possibly present. It's one of the reasons why we put together this team of people, because between us, we were able to hammer out a lot of the biases that each of us had individually by pointing out, well, that's not necessarily an objective opinion, that's more an objective fact, that's a subjective opinion. As part of that, we also wanted to be very careful. There are 9 options included in this. And each of us has a personal preference, but none of us wanted to be personally identified with any of the particular options, A, because we wanted the options to stand on their own, and B, because we wanted to have the freedom to present them in as strong a form as possible without necessarily being identified with any single one of them. So please don't assume that this chapter represents so-and-so's views and this other chapter represents another of our views. This is a collective product, and as I said, we tried to write it so that it would stand on its own. As you'll see down at the bottom of the slide, one of the other things that we did was we farmed out the manuscript to about a dozen outside experts on Iran, some of them highly partisan from both sides of the spectrum, as well as Iranian Americans and longtime American Iran watchers, again, to try to get a sense of where there was still residual bias and to make sure that each option was treated as fairly as possible, both by those who actually subscribed to it, and by those who disliked it. And I think that the final product is not a bad one in terms of trying to achieve those different goals. Okay, again, the purpose is manifold. Because of the timing, we were able actually to provide an assessment of the Obama administration's approach to Iran. That'll be the first one that we talk about. But of course, we also, as Martin suggested, wanted to look at all of the alternatives, both because they can serve as contingency plans and fallback options, and also because at some point in time, the United States simply may decide that it wants to do something differently. A different Congress, a different president, a president who wakes up on the other side of the bed may all decide that he wants to do or she wants to do something differently, depending on what the circumstances are. And because all of the options are so rotten, and that is the one big takeaway from it, which I'll talk about several times, there's no clear-cut winner. There's no obvious solution to the problem that we face with Iran, and that's why we wanted to look at all 9 of these and treat each of them with an equal degree of seriousness and an equal degree of depth. And finally, just this last point I think is an important one, which is that one of the things that we had seen in the policy debate on Iran is that oftentimes many people were arguing past each other because, in fact, they wanted to achieve very different things in Iran or with Iran. Some people were out there saying, well, all we really need to do is deal with Iran's nuclear program and everything else is fine. And there were other people who believed just as vehemently that if you didn't replace the regime, nothing else mattered. And that a lot of the divergence and the differences among people within the debate here was based on these differing goals and these different approaches and different thinking about what the time available was. And so we wanted to put them all out in an objective fashion in a similar standardized template so that you could compare all of these different options and recognize where the differences lay between them. So this is the standardized template we used. Each chapter considers the goal of the policy, its time frame, and by time frame, the amount of time it would reasonably take to achieve success. And each policy defines its own version of success. That's where the goals come in. An overview of what the policy would look like, the requirements to give it the best chance of success, the pros and cons. And again, you will find, as you go through this, that all of the options had far more and far bigger cons than they did pros. That's just part of the joy of dealing with the problem of Iran. So let me run you quickly through the 9 options that we looked at. And again, just to keep things short so that we can spend most of the time on what's going on now, I am going to be very brief and only touch on some highlights. The first policy we chose to call persuasion. This is the Obama administration's policy. Just a couple of things to highlight. As we say, this is, and as the president said, this is really the strategy of carrots and sticks. But one of the biggest things, and one of the areas where we felt that the administration had not done a great job in pursuing this option, was that you don't talk about the sticks. Okay? Everyone knows the sticks are out there, including the Iranians. It simply backs them into a corner to threaten them with the sticks. And that, in fact, the smartest thing you could do if you were going to pursue a policy of persuasion was call it a policy of engagement, which we're going to come to in just a second. And that has the virtue of being true because, say, in the next tick, this is a strategy which, or policy option which includes engagement as a tactic, as a way of broaching the subject to the Iranians and exploring what kind of a relationship they would like. And as the president has suggested, if they make it clear they want a better relationship, then it can become a strategic engagement with Iran. If not, it becomes something else altogether. And then just the last point to highlight on this, the big requirement, the obvious requirement, is the importance of international support. This policy simply can't work without international support. And especially given some of the comments that we've seen from some of the key international players over the last few days, one of the big cons that we find out there and has been reinforced by the events of the last 2 weeks is that it's not at all clear that we're going to have the kind of international support that would be necessary to actually make this policy work. We then looked at what's called a policy of engagement. And here what we were looking at is, again, not what the administration is calling engagement, because in truth, that's the carrots and sticks. Rightly, they're calling it engagement. But it's an older policy, a policy that's been around for at least 5 or 6 years, and it stems from the analytic consensus among certain Iran experts that Iran does not respond well to threats at all, that the sticks are what undermines any kind of a policy of creating incentives for Iran. That is, that the sticks are what undermine persuasion. And therefore, what you have to do is go for a policy of all carrots. Okay. What's important here is to note is, first, the time frame, which probably should have been bolded in red. Okay. Because it's a policy of all carrots, it's about engagement. It's typically referred to as a China approach, where we simply make it clear to the Iranians we want a better relationship, and over a period of time, as it was the case with China, over time, Iran recognizes that we're not a threat, improves its behavior toward us, and allows for a reconciliation. The problem, of course, with this one is that first, in the short term, it's really hard to avoid Iran's hardliners claiming this is a victory. Okay? Their argument all along has been the outside world needs us more than we need the outside world. And if we simply hang tough, they'll come around and let us do whatever we want. And by giving up all the forms of pressure, giving up the sanctions, giving up all the sticks that are inherent in persuasion, engagement makes it that much more likely that the hardliners will be able to declare victory and that Iran will continue to pursue its nuclear weapons capability program, that it will continue to pursue its support for terrorism, etc., and that if we get there, if we actually get to this better relationship, it's going to take a long time, and Iranian behavior is probably going to get worse before it gets better, if it gets better at all. Obviously, not everyone is interested in these more diplomatic approaches toward Iran. So we also decided to look at three different military options toward Iran. The first one is the big enchilada, the invasion. Okay. This basically stems from the idea of, all right, we got all these different problems with Iran. The one thing out there that would solve all of our current problems with Iran would be to pull in Iran what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. Go in, invade the country, topple the regime, uproot the nuclear program, start all over again from scratch. This has got some obvious problems with it, too. As I pointed out at the bottom, perhaps third time will be a charm, but we haven't gotten it right the first two times we've tried this, and I think that we have to ask ourselves how much domestic political support, let alone international support, but how much domestic political support there would be for another major military operation and another major nation-building exercise in the Middle East. And unfortunately, the more that we looked at this, the more that we felt that it really wasn't conceivable to do the invasion and the regime change without everything that went with it, without the nation-building effort that would inevitably have to follow. So if you don't like invasion, if that's too big, well, what about airstrikes? That tends to be the military option that most people who favor military options like. And we looked hard at this. And there are at least two different sets of problems that are worth bringing up. One is the one that I think most people know about and talk about, which is it's just not clear what even massive American airstrikes would do to the Iranian nuclear program. You know, in particular, let's say our intelligence was perfect. Let's say we flew thousands of strike sorties and cruise missile strikes against the Iranian sites, and we flattened every single building that the Iranians had connected with their nuclear program. And let's say that we knew about where every one of them was. Right now, there's a lot of debate among the experts as to how long it would take the Iranians to rebuild the nuclear program from scratch. But the estimates all seem to range from 1 to 2 years to maybe 3 or 4 at the outset. And given all the other downsides that would accrue, and we talk about them in this chapter, it's not clear that the payoff is there. But there's a second set of problems with it that we didn't really feel that people had thought too much about that kind of emerged as a result of this exercise, which is that airstrikes are a one-shot deal. Okay? The United States is not going to mount several thousand sorties against the Iranians every 3 or 4 years to shut down their nuclear program. And since the first round of strikes would likely empower Iran's hardliners and convince them to redouble their efforts to acquire a nuclear weapon, chances are this would not solve the problem for all time. But the problem is once you've done the strikes, it then becomes very hard to do anything else as a follow-up. In an ideal world, what you'd want is you'd want the strikes and then the harsher sanctions. But the problem is the strikes are probably going to eliminate all of the sanctions and eliminate any likelihood of getting future sanctions. So the airstrikes option has a problem not only in terms of its short term, what it would actually achieve, but in terms of its longer term, in how it can be turned into a more sustainable policy of dealing with Iran. And beyond that, of course, it does nothing about those other aspects of Iranian behavior. It has no answer for what to do about Iran's support for terrorist groups and its opposition to the status quo and everything else it does. It is very narrowly focused on only one aspect of our problems with Iran. We also, of course, had to look at the other big military option that's out there, which is, as the chapter is called in the book, Leave It to Bibi, allowing the Israelis to take care of the problem for us because we don't have the cojones to do it. And there are obviously a lot of people out there who kind of would like to see this happen. There are even some people in the Gulf who'd like to see this happen. Looking at it from an American perspective, though, I have to say we really didn't find a whole lot to recommend it. The strike would likely be smaller than any American effort and therefore less likely to achieve even what an American strike would achieve. It would have all of the same downsides as the American strike. And beyond that, especially with Bibi Netanyahu as prime minister, because of the likelihood that Hezbollah would retaliate and how Bibi would probably feel compelled to respond to that, it probably would be that the Israeli strike is simply the overture to another major Israeli operation in Lebanon, which would not be helpful either. So then we looked at some regime change options. If the military ones were problematic, and of course they were, just as all of them were, we wanted to look at regime change. And one of our chapters is called The Velvet Revolution. And in reading it over last night, I think you will find quite a bit about how to think about what's been going on over the last 2 weeks in this chapter, where we talk about how the United States might try to encourage and then take advantage of a popular rising against the regime. But it's worth highlighting a few things, and I highlighted a few more because of recent developments on this one, which is first note, of course, that the goal has changed in fundamental ways. As opposed to some of the previous policies, which were much more focused on Iranian behavior or even just narrowly focused on the Iranian nuclear program, this is all about the regime. And this stems from the feeling that among many Americans that it's not the behavior, it is the regime itself that is the problem. Second, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, it is impossible to predict revolutions. It is impossible to predict when they will try to start. It is impossible to predict when they will succeed. Okay. Scholars have failed to ever predict a revolution successfully. They have failed even to retrodict revolutions in history. We just don't know how to do it. It's simply too difficult. So if you're thinking about this as a policy, you can't attach a particular time frame to it. You can't say, well, the Iranians are going to have a nuclear weapon in 3 years, so we have to have the Velvet Revolution in 2. Okay? You can say that, but there's no way to actually make it happen. We just don't know how. Requirements. As we've also seen, it's very hard to know how to help these revolutions succeed. It's hard to know what they need to succeed. Sometimes you just have to get lucky. And one of the things that we might have faced had this gone on longer and had the United States encouraged it would have been the very unpleasant circumstances of had the regime cracked down harder. Would the United States found itself in a position of having to intervene or consider intervening to stop a bloodbath, having encouraged the revolt in the first place? And was in some of our minds was what happened in Iraq during the Gulf War, where George H.W. Bush encouraged the Iraqis to rise up. They did. We failed to support them, and 100,000 Iraqis were killed. Not something that we necessarily want to see replicated in Iran. And then the last points, of course, which we've all been talking about, which are worth keeping in mind. Again, the only way that revolutions seem to succeed or a necessary precondition is that the regime has to lose the will or the capacity to employ violence. It's not clear how the United States would enable that from our distance. We clearly have not done so this time around. And, of course, there is the other issue which the Obama administration has been grappling with, which is how does the great Satan, how does the United States, which has been the third rail, the political football of Iranian politics for 30 years, how do we help a genuine uprising of the Iranian people without actually discrediting that movement? Another idea that's out there and certainly has a lot of adherence in Washington is the idea of supporting some kind of insurgency. The Mujahideen Khalq, which many of you are aware of, that's exactly what the U.S. would like, or what they would like the U.S. to do, using them as the insurgent group. The issue that we've got out there is that it requires a capable insurgency with widespread appeal. And we don't yet have an Iranian group that meets both of those criteria. The good thing about an insurgency is we actually know how to do it. The con is, as said, it's not clear we have the tools, and it will take a very long time if it works at all. We also looked at the possibility of a military coup. At least three of us have CIA backgrounds, so we have at least some experience working with people who do this for a living. And what we found there is, again, the time frame is impossible to predict. Because at the end of the day, you're trying to reach out to people in another country who are going to have to do the heavy lifting themselves. Okay? It becomes the military officers in Iran, the cabal itself, that has to pull the trigger. And our ability to control them, to encourage them, is extremely limited. So it happens on their timetable, when they're ready. And they have to have the courage to be ready, and they have to have the skill and the experience to know when the time is right. And all we can do is hope that they're right and maybe give them a little bit of intelligence. And intelligence becomes the critical issue in it because given a closed society like Iran's with a paranoid regime, it becomes incredibly difficult for Americans to reach out, meet, vet, and aid would-be coup plotters without actually exposing them to the Iranian secret police and having the coup plot snuffed out in its cradle. And then the last containment, always the last. When all else fails, if we can't come to some kind of a negotiated agreement with the Iranians, if we can't develop a better relationship with the Iranians, if we can't invade them or bomb them, if we can't overthrow them, we just have to find a way to live with them and to limit the amount of damage that they can do. And of course, here, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that containment would be feasible, even if it would be very unpalatable. But the big question out there, the really big issue that no one can ultimately answer, is the question of whether a nuclear Iran, and containment assumes that because we're not going to stop the nuclear program, it will come to fruition and there will be a nuclear-armed Iran, whether that nuclear-armed Iran can be deterred. There's a lot of debate over the issue. We all have our personal opinions. We tried to keep them out of this, but that will be the critical issue on which it all hinges. In the end, the concluding chapter, we look at the future. We talk about uncertainties. Martin is right. There is a whole section called Expecting the Unexpected, which talks about how things in Iran happen that we have no way of predicting. But the other thing that we do in that last chapter is talk about how difficult the problem is and therefore the need to try to integrate several of the policies to craft a better, more sophisticated, more nuanced, and more able policy that can deal with some of this. And just to give you one quick idea of what we have in mind, persuasion, one of the reasons why persuasion has a lot of appeal is because it can be married up very nicely with so many of the other policy options. As I mentioned before, persuasion is ultimately putting a choice to the Iranians, which is, we're going to give you a choice, and that choice is ultimately going to be between engagement. If you actually want to do the right thing and have a better relationship, we will then turn this into a policy of strategic engagement or a much, much tougher form of containment than what you've seen so far. That's the whole point of the harsher sanctions. But it could also set up military action if you wanted it to. You try the route of engagement, you try this approach, and if it fails, well, then you can go to the international community and say, we gave it our best shot, now we got to start bombing. This, of course, is exactly what a lot of Iranians are terrified of. They're afraid that our policy is nothing but a facade for the bombing campaign that they think so many Americans would like to employ. And then finally, you could imagine employing, as the Bushis tried to, elements of regime change as another form of pressure. And so it is a way of integrating all of them together, a way of thinking about these as being pieces of a larger whole, one that will hopefully give you a better chance to deal with the problem of Iran than any of these policies would individually. Thank you very much.
Precisely because that was the purpose of the exercise, to allow you to go through the play the role of policymaker and make up your own mind or mix and match the options and see whether you can come up with a better one than anybody else. Good luck. Suzanne, why don't you bring us up to date in terms of the current situation and how the option of engagement, or what we call persuasion, is going to fare as a result of developments there.
Sure. Thank you very much, Martin and Ken, and thank you all for being here. I have the unenviable task of trying to brief you all on a situation that is evolving by the minute and that defies all of our ability to both analyze and predict, because to some extent most of the most relevant information is very difficult to obtain at this stage. So I, like you, have been following the internet with rapt attention and have come away from the past 10 days of near shock at what is happening on the ground with a couple of conclusions that I wanted to talk about today, and look forward to the discussion both among the rest of the panel but also with the audience. I think, to my mind, first and most important as a caveat, but as a reminder for all of us whenever we talk about Iran, is simply how unimaginable this scenario was even a mere 2 weeks ago. There were many of us and many of you I know in the audience who have been attending events and participating in discussions on the Iranian election for months now. This is a predictable event, and it was a contested event, and I think everybody understood it was going to be an important and an interesting election because it involved the fate of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, because Iranian elections have proven so difficult to interpret in advance, as we've seen time and again, and because this is such an important moment at the outset of a new American administration. So there's been a lot of attention around this election. And I can say with a certain degree of confidence that no one in this town, and I would suspect no one in many foreign capitals or perhaps even within Iran itself, expected the series of events that we've seen over the past 10 days. We all recognize that there would be some manipulation of the outcome of the elections. Some predicted more, some predicted less. No one predicted the degree of blatant rigging of the election that we saw 10 days ago. No one predicted that the ostensibly losing candidate, reformist Mir Hussein Mousavi, a longtime functionary of the Islamic Republic, someone who had effectively run the government during the period of the war with Iraq, but had been absent from politics for most of the past two decades, would emerge as the single political figure within the Iranian establishment in the past 30 years to defy the express edict of Ayatollah Khamenei. And no one predicted that with this defiance, together we would see a defiance on the streets, which has been at least as dramatic and as important and as long-lasting as what we're seeing within the political establishment. Obviously, today, we recognize that there has at least been temporarily, for the moment, a successful crackdown by the regime, a crackdown both in terms of physical repression of the protest, which has driven the numbers down from the hundreds of thousands, perhaps million, who amassed in the streets of Tehran in the immediate aftermath of the announcement of the Ahmadinejad, quote-unquote, landslide, to the tens of thousands and maybe even numbers as small as hundreds who have been on the streets in the past day or so. We've also seen, obviously, a very successful crackdown in terms of information that's being both passed around Iran, but I think also in terms of the reporting. There's been a phenomenal amount of independent amateur media, and I know that there are many around this town who are analyzing the impact of Twitter or cell phones and new technology on both protests, the way that they develop on the street, but also the way that they captivate an international audience. All that has been quite important, but clearly we are seeing far less reporting on exactly what's happening on the ground, far less information coming out of some of the key political actors, simply because those reporters who are still left in Iran are, in many cases, under severe restrictions, in prison, and many others have been forced to leave the country. But Martin, at the outset of our discussion today, posed a question which I will at least try to take an answer to. He asked, is this the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end? And I'm going to maybe split the difference. I think what we've seen is the end of a chapter, but the beginning of a very profound and important story in Iran. And again, one that I certainly did not anticipate and will be watching with very rapt attention over the next few weeks. Let me just say, I think that what we've seen was unprecedented. I was in Iran 10 years ago this month, or next month, when the student protests erupted in the streets of Tehran, arrived in the midst of those protests to see the crackdown and to get a sense of what the experience on the streets and the mood of the people was. I can tell you, although I haven't been in Iran, obviously, over the past 10 days, what we're seeing and what we have seen over this period is profoundly different. Far more important, far more long-lasting. It is not to suggest that the July 99 protests, the June 2003 student protests, other periods of unrest in Iran, and frankly, there have been many with a certain degree of regularity that the regime has withstood and repressed without dramatic differences in the way that the politics are run in Iran or the relationship between the government and its people. This is something profoundly different and more important. I think it's broad, it's multifaceted. We're seeing protests, we saw protests of a magnitude and scope unlike anything that we saw in July of 1999 that impacted the lives of Iranians, even those who were far from the scene of the events. And we're seeing, I think, ultimately, events that are changing the structure of power in Iran that will impact our policies and our choices in the international community. Let me just explain why I think this is so, even though I do believe that the regime has successfully cracked down, and at least for the moment, we're not going to see a million people amassing on the streets of Tehran. I believe what's happened in the past 10 days has created, for the first time in the aftermath of the revolution, a serious opposition movement. This is one of the issues that many of us looking at Iran always felt was missing. When people talked about popular dissatisfaction, it was clearly true. You felt it when you spoke to Iranians, you saw it. But it was open dissatisfaction. It was never organized. It had never coalesced into anything remotely resembling a movement. There were student groups, there were labor unions, there were organizations of women and others that were mobilizing to try to express unhappiness over particular demands. There were reformist political parties. There were semi-tolerated oppositions like the Iran Freedom Movement. But there was nothing that resembled the kind of broad-based, organized movement that one would need if one was going to see something along the lines of a revolution or a regime change. We don't have that yet today, but we have at least the start of it. We have the seeds of it for the very first time in Iranian history. Clearly, what happened over the past 10 days, much of it has been spontaneous, amorphous, chaotic, but we have at least the skeletal structure of a movement. I don't know that we can even identify it from here because so much of it has been outside of our range of vision. So much of it has been happening over this new media, over cell phones. But Iranians are communicating with one another, they're organizing, they're developing slogans, and they're developing strategies for confronting the regime. And that is really a first, I think, in post-revolutionary history at the scope and level that we're seeing. Equally as important, I think, we have seen the emergence of a leadership, an opposition leadership. Frankly, there has been a longstanding contention within the regime, really since the days leading up to the revolution. This was a coalition that unseated the Shah that never agreed on anything beyond the fundamental aim of eliminating the monarchy. But there was never agreement, and there's always been feuds, even fierce feuding, even during the days of Ayatollah Khomeini. And it has certainly entrenched itself and gotten worse over recent years. But we've never had anyone that we could point to as a potential opposition leader. And frankly, at different points in time, I might have identified individuals who I thought might take on that kind of a role. Ghulam Hussein Karbashchi, the strategist who helped plan the original Khatami victory. Abdullahi Nouri, the interior minister under Khatami, who was imprisoned for his comments on America, Israel, and other issues. A number of other people whom you might have pointed to as having potentially either the organizational capacity or the leadership potential to begin to draw supporters and to lead some sort of a movement against the regime in a serious way. I would never have pointed to Mir Hussein Mousavi, and yet in many respects he is a natural candidate for this role, in part because of his experience during the Iran-Iraq War, when he fought some of the fiercest ideological battles of the regime's history. He was, in many ways, the original Ahmadinejad, a radical leftist who fought bitterly with many of his rivals within the government and tried to amass as much authority underneath the structure of the state as was possible. But clearly, over his two decades in political exile, he has come to a different understanding of the nature of power and is prepared in a way that I simply never would have imagined possible to confront the regime and to continue to lead these protests, to call for defiance, even though he recognizes that this sort of thing typically doesn't end well. The last putative Iranian president who tried to lead protests in the streets was Abu Hassan Banisadr, who fled Iran during the Civil War, reportedly at least, according to the apocryphal stories that go around, dressed in women's clothing. So Mousavi knows what he was getting into. He knew from day one, by defying Khamenei's congratulation of Ahmadinejad, he was moving beyond the red lines, as they say, in Iranian politics in a way that was irrevocable and meaningful. He may not be the organizational leader of this movement, but he has certainly become the symbolic leader of a movement, and that is quite important. At a lower level, we're likely to see the development of other leaders of a potential opposition. There have been hundreds of activists, dissidents, journalists, intellectuals who've been put in prison over the past week. Many of these were individuals who have been confronting the structure of power in Iran in different ways, but had not broken with the system of the Islamic Republic. I suspect some time in Evin will change their calculus, at least for many. And simply the recognition that what has happened in Iran is so unprecedented, even within the bounds of the semi-competitive elections that Iran has had for 30 years, nothing like this has ever happened before, is going to change the calculus for many, as it did, for example, for former President Khatami, who certainly didn't go to the barricades back in 99 or 2003 when students were risking their lives, when students were mobilizing in the streets in defense of the ideals that he proclaimed. But in fact came out and backed Mousavi and has continued to support this effort in a way that many of those who have derided Khatami as a political coward perhaps did not think possible. So with the change in the context comes the change in individuals, and I think that we will see that over time, and it will be something that we simply have to watch. Who comes out of prison a changed man or a changed woman? And there are a lot of people who've been sent to prison in the past 10 days or so. A couple of other points just on why I think this is an irrevocable change and a fundamental change in the system of power in Iran. What we saw in this power grab, and I think there's really no debate that that's what it was an effort and an inevitability of narrowing the regime's base. One of the advantages, one of the pillars of support of the Islamic Republic for the past 30 years is this connection that the people had. They may not have liked their government, but it was their government. They had a greater stake in it than many of their neighbors did. They criticized it intensely wherever you went in the streets, and yet they saw no value in outsiders intervening in that struggle. There were many who benefited from the regime across the board, who participated in the regime, who again did not like it, but whether they had passports that let them go abroad, whether they were able to make some money from the oil boom of recent years, whatever it was, they found a way to live within the structure of power of Iran. Today, that base is considerably narrowed. Clearly, there is a vast schism that is underway within the revolutionary elders, and certainly between the first generation and the second generation of the revolutionary technocracy. And we don't know exactly who sits on what side at this point. You know, obviously, all eyes are on the missing figure of Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, the former president, the political godfather of Iran, who heads two very important institutions, but also, and perhaps more importantly, is a figure of great influence behind the scenes, has not been heard from over the past 10 days, but is presumed to be doing a lot of negotiating behind the scenes. Where he comes out will obviously be important, but the fact is we know that there are many, like Khatami, like others, who have already made their choice and have been divided from Khamenei and Ahmadinejad in meaningful ways. The base of support of the Islamic Republic at this stage lies with some small but important constituency of popular opinion who rally around Ahmadinejad's populist views among a hardcore defense of the most basic ideals of the clerical element of the revolutionaries, but also importantly among the Revolutionary Guard. And I think that is where the base of power of this regime now lies, no longer with the traditional clergy, no longer with many of the merchants who've benefited from the regime, no longer with the people who felt at least a stake in the outcome and a stake in their government. That simply doesn't exist anymore. Beyond Rafsanjani, I think we've seen Ahmadinejad considerably weakened by these events. This entire effort was evidently intended to engineer a mandate for the president that was unparalleled in Iranian history. He was going to come away with more votes, a greater percentage of the vote, a greater turnout than even Mohammad Khatami had. And perhaps that was meant to empower him in a way to do important and potentially even useful things from our point of view. I've heard the notion that somehow a narrowed, consolidated, hardline regime might be more amenable to outreach with the United States. I'm dubious of it. But if that was the intention, I think that Ahmadinejad has clearly undercut his mandate tremendously, because both at home and abroad, he has shown himself to be a petty dictator. He has alienated beyond revocation much of the political elite, the clergy, in a way that I think leaves the presidency that he initially sought to empower far weaker and far more imperiled for the future. Just a couple of kind of concluding comments. As I said, I think this is the beginning of a very important story for Iran. I don't have any real prediction as to where it leads, but I think that we are certainly in the long term going to see a far more democratic Iran than even those of us who are optimistic about the country might have said a week or two or three ago. I think we also recognize how important the democratic experience